Doctor.
But it sounds something like this.
Hi, all. Welcome back to The Drip, the podcast where four academics of color sit around in coffee shops and discuss great books. Each episode will feature a free-flowing conversation about one book that leads us to a broader conversation about race, politics, culture, all the things that keep us gabbing when we're hanging out in coffee shops, which is actually where we are right now. So my name is Anita Chikatur, and I teach in the Educational Studies Department at Carleton College.
And I'm Crystal Motz, and I teach history at McAllister College.
I'm Adriana Estel, and I teach American Studies and English at Carleton College.
I'm Todd Lawrence, and I teach cultural studies in English at the University of St. Thomas.
So in this episode, we're discussing Eve Ewing's collection of poetry and art in her new book, Electric Arches. Eve Louise Ewing is a sociologist of education, woohoo, whose research is focused on racism, social inequality, and urban policy, and the impact of those forces on American public schools and the lives of young people. Currently, she is a provost postdoctoral scholar at the University of Chicago, and in fall 2018, she's going to begin as an assistant professor in the School of Social Work Administration at the University of Chicago. So before we start, just a reminder that when we discuss our books, we talk about everything. So consider this your perpetual, universal, all-compassing spoiler alert. So in other words, as Adriana says, we're all about the spoilers and not about summaries. So we're going to dig in. And I want to start us off by asking two questions about poetry's relevance and accessibility. And maybe y'all can tackle those questions using Electric Arches as an example. So the first question I have is, why should we be reading poetry, writing poetry, when there's so many things going on in the world, right? There's people being slaughtered in Syria and Yemen. There's undocumented children and families in the U.S. who are living in such uncertainty about what's going to happen to them. It's the 50th year anniversary of the Kerner Report, and there's analyses that show that basically we're, you know, no better off, in many cases actually worse off, right? So given all of that, like, why is poetry relevant or important, right? Why should we spend time reading Electric Arches? And I think of it's a big question. Big question.
My question.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
And I guess
see you next time.
And the other big question, which I think is related, right, is about like poetry's accessibility. And I feel like I'm someone who's always been kind of intimidated by poetry. And there were moments in like Electric Arches when I felt that too. Although a lot of it actually I felt like was accessible. But I feel like reading poetry and sometimes even just the thought of reading poetry makes me feel like, I don't know, like I don't have the right analytic tools or the cultural capital or, I don't know, the right amount of soul to like understand poetry.
You got soul.
So why should someone like me read Electric Arches?
Do you mind if I jump in? Because I am really taken by your question about relevance, and it has to do, actually, I think you're right, those questions about relevance and accessibility are totally interrelated. Because if you feel like something is off here, high culture, and meaningless, right, of course you don't think of it as intertwined with the very problems we have in our everyday lives and that we are so concerned about right now. One thing that I loved about Eve Ewing's book, though, is this way in which she uses poetry to really blast open future possibilities. And I'm using the blast really intentionally here. There are poems in the series that's called Retellings, where the story starts out, and it reminded me a lot of Claudine Rankine's Citizen collection, where there are prose poetry, dense microaggressive stories, right? Eve Ewing is doing something really similar, but with each of these retellings, there's a point at which the typed word ends and the handwritten begins, and in that handwriting emerges these fantastic, utopic possibilities, which are not quite revenge stories, which I also appreciated. They're more like what could be in a more perfect world. Go ahead, jump in.
No, I totally agree with that. I was thinking of, you were talking about Audre Lorde before we started recording, and Audre Lorde, of course, the famous claim, poetry is not a luxury, right? And all of those things that you're talking about, which seem so, you know, horrible and intractable and, you know, so large and systemic, we can't we can't really think about and understand issues that are going on in the world without what she calls like a certain quality of light, right? Which we have to get into a kind of way of thinking about things that comes from inside of ourselves, and poetry helps us to do that, I think. And I think you see that in this book, you know, you see that time and time again, where this book has poems that are about drawing out things out of yourself, right? Like, I was thinking about, I'm really bad at remembering the names of the poems, so I'm just gonna be like, there's this one poem that I'm gonna say
we'll
some
try
stuff.
And help.
Right, so there's the poem where she is talking about Erykah Badu's Badu-ism.
Yes. Yes.
And, you know, really talking about how Erykah Badu inspired her in this particular moment in her life. Mm-hmm. But what she's talking about is drawing something out of yourself that. That this kind of fuel, I think she uses the word fuel over, and you see that over and over again in the collection. So I think, you know, poetry can do that for us. It can, you know, I remember when I was in school, some old crusty professor basically said that, probably wasn't crusty, but said that poetry is supposed to make us see things differently, right? The technical term is astronomy. You know that word?
No.
Making strange to make strange.
Oh, I love it.
So he would talk about like, well, if someone just writes a poem
to make
about
the familiar strange.
To defamiliarize, to make strange. If someone just writes a poem about a tree with its leaves and stuff that you've seen every day, it's not that interesting a poem. But when someone writes a poem that turns it in a way that you've never seen it.
Yeah.
And these poems do that a lot, I think. And they take everyday things, like the piece of hair, you know. Adriana's got her book open to the page where there's written
33.
Page 33. I saw it in the bathtub. I thought it was a spider, but it was my hair.
Which has totally happened to me.
But I mean, it to see it written in a book of poetry makes you see that in a different way, that whole, you know?
That those moments, you are being poetic as you look at the world and you see things that are both there and not there. I don't want to go to the Badu poem. Because I'll let you come back to it.
Can I just interject
totally.
To tell you why poetry is relevant to me?
Yes.
Tell me.
If I'm being honest and not at all hyperbolic, I would not be where I am today without poetry.
Wow.
And I grew up reading poetry not only as a way to see kind of the strangeness and the familiar, but also to see myself in a world where I wasn't reflected very well. And so when I think of growing up in Eve's 1980s Southside Chicago, now she grew up on the west side, I grew up on the south side, but I very much saw my growing up days reflected here. So growing up, reading Langston Hughes, Nikki Giovanni, Naomi Long Magid, Margaret Walker, allowed me to see myself in different ways. But then also there was a tradition on the south side where I lived. I lived in the 6th Ward of Chicago, and the 6th Ward had an annual oratory contest. And so at the oratory contest for years on end, I would always perform black poetry. And so not only did I see myself in the poetry, but the poetry and my recitation of it kind of developed my oral communication skills. And so poetry has not only been kind of this creative endeavor, but it's also been a way of, you know, developing a skill set for me. And so while I may not have been always able to understand what was going on in the poetry, it allowed me to see a black world that I hadn't seen before.
I think that last piece is super important, both things that you said, because being able to be in a poem but not understand a poem, but just to be in it and the emotion of it and the feeling of it is important, because a lot of people think that, you know, we were talking about this before we started, a lot of my students, they've been, I don't think teachers tell them this, but somehow they've gotten this message that a poem is something to figure out.
Right.
It's a magic box, and you got to find the key to open it.
And there's only one key.
And I don't have it.
Right.
Exactly.
Right. And I assume it's like they raise their hand and they say, "I think this poem is about this," and the teacher says, "No, it isn't. It's about this, right?"
Right.
And that shuts them down.
Down. Yeah.
But you can be in a poem. I mean, poems have sound. Poems have rhythm.
Yes.
Poems have all this stuff besides the meaning of the words or the figurative language or whatever. Sometimes I really feel
look what I wrote down here. Poetry slow down, sit in these words.
Yes.
Because I think that's exactly what poetry calls us to do.
Yeah.
To feel them really deeply.
Right.
Even when you don't understand them. Right. Because you're gonna feel your way into what you need to understand of it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And there's something about poetry that's different than any other type of literature to me, because for me, poetry to me needs, it's an embodied experience. And I think growing up reciting poetry, that's how I encountered it. So it wasn't just, reading the poetry on the page, but, when I would perform, The Negro Mother by Langston Hughes, it was putting myself in that time frame, putting myself in the experience of an enslaved woman and what it was like to toil and what it was like to lose your children, or reciting Nikki Giovanni's Ego Tripping. It was affirming myself and all of the possibilities of my womanhood and truly embodying that. And so poetry has always come off the page and become something for me and within me, to me, and which made me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That is kind of beautiful.
One thing I like about the way Eve Ewing does it too, because there are all sorts of, we were talking before about this accessibility issue being about language, right, and understanding, but there's also content and topic, like what is supposed to be the topic of poetry? And what Eve Ewing does is say, no, you know what? I am going to talk about Matthew Henson's fursuit.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
I am going to have this requiem for Fifth Period and the things that went on then.
Yes.
Where she takes, fourth and fifth graders and the workings of a school, and she makes us see both the beauty and the sadness of this educational process, right? So that it ends. Tell muse of the siren that called their joy sparse and their love vacant. Tell of the wind that scattered them. So she's taking these tropes from Western, cultural poetry, poetics, and saying, imagine that Chicago, deserves these voices too. Yeah. How do they change?
Yeah.
How do they become part of this larger story?
So two things in thinking about kind of the subject and the topic of poetry. I just made a list of some of the topics, not all of them, but the topics that kind of resonated with me. And, knowing that Eve Ewing was writing this as kind of a reflection on Black girlhood and knowing her Chicago roots, I was like, okay, let's see how she handles Chicago, because I tell people I'm a Chicago girl. I'm not from the suburbs.
I forgot you're from Chicago.
And so we can tell right now.
I should have known this was coming.
And so I was like, well, let me see how she, treats my Chicago. But the first, in the note of introduction, she says, when I was a little girl, I was allowed to ride my bicycle from one end of the block to the other, and then that's where I knew she had me. And she had me because bicycles and riding bikes in Chicago, and particularly on the South Side, like riding to and from your house to the lake, was just something I grew up doing. And so this experience of riding bikes, of experiencing Chicago in that way, she just got me. But then she goes on to talk about hair and skin and history and neo-soul in the 1980s and hot crunchy curls, which are a vintner's project, a product which is made and manufactured in Chicago.
Oh, wow.
Then talking about religion in the Black church, education in public schools. And so all of these kind of topics that she gets into are all topics that made this feel really authentic to me. The furtive trips to Walgreens. I mean, just so many things that maybe they would resonate with others not from Chicago, but that they're in this.
It resonates with me.
Yeah.
I think it's a really great example of world building, of sort of creating this entire world for us to inhabit. And even if I didn't grow up in Chicago, I grew up in a little town in Missouri, but a lot of the things that she talks about still touch me. I mean, I guess I grew up in the 80s, but I mean, I think about Shaba. Well, a lot of it's about Blackness too,
yes,
right?
If
you're Black, you, when she, the Shea Butter Manifesto.
Yes.
828.
I mean, 28.
Yeah, I had it open. Yeah.
I mean, that poem to me.
Yes.
If you're a little Black kid, like mm-hmm. I once was. One of your
you still are in your
heart. Well, one of your most terrifying nightmares is to go to school without getting lotioned up, without having lotion
be
on.
Be ashy.
And be ashy at
this
school.
This line mm-hmm. right here, knowing that ash is the language of the dead.
Of the dead.
It's yes. so brilliant yeah. because it calls yeah. in religious language and right. puts us next mm-hmm. to kind of black corporeal knowledge.
Right, yes. and exactly. Yeah. And it takes something that is an everyday... Mm-hmm. Reality for black people yeah. and turns it into something that's yes. much more elevated yeah. and bigger. Mm. I mean, even, you know, this mm-hmm. is a manifesto, right?
Right, yeah. mm-hmm. right.
A manifesto is a statement yes. of power. Yes. It's a statement about something, taking a position yes. on something. Yes. And this is to take a position on to shine, right?
Yes.
To take this, what people might see as a deficiency and turn yes. it into something mm-hmm. that is a power,
yes.
right?
Yes.
And so to end with, I mean, I yeah. you know, those last few lines, mm-hmm. in this world, nothing brittle prevails. So in this world, Greece is a compliment. No, it's a weapon. Mm. No, it's a dream you had where it was cold and your mother seeing the thread of gray at your elbows and knowing that ash is the language of the dead, which you just said, knelt and put her hands on your face like this and anointed you a protected child, a hot iron in a place of frost. Recall this and fear no thickness, be resurrected. Glistening in the story of you be shining.
Yes.
Like, so beautiful.
Yeah. It's like a religious ceremony.
Yes.
Right? When it happened to you, you were like, man.
Yeah. Right, right,
no,
exactly.
No, you know. But then I look back at it, I was like, oh. No. That was my mom protecting me.
Yes.
That was my mom putting like a shield on
yes,
me. Right?
Yes.
And sending me out into the cold, mean world.
Right.
But she was sending me with a piece of her mm-hmm. and with some kind of, you mm-hmm. know, power that's yes. shining.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the shea butter could be baby oil or Vaseline.
Yes.
either one could be substituted.
Absolutely.
Something for the cookies.
Yes.
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 I guess a couple of things as somebody who's like listening in. Mm-hmm. So I would say like I think some of you made this point, right? Like, I think poetry is presented, at least in, like, schooling, right, as this sort of, like, thing that we look at only as text, and it's not mm-hmm. necessarily recited, it's not necessarily that, but it's also that, right, I don't know, that in my, you know, teachers were ever like, what do you feel when you read this, right? Like, what resonates with you? Because you just read that, and it's beautiful.
Yeah.
Right? And it's, like, really, yeah. So, anyway, I just wanted to say, I appreciate that, like, that's how you're talking about it, because I don't think that's how I was taught to think about it.
I think people often think, well, and we're taught this, what is poetry? It's like this Greek stuff. Mm-hmm. It's like this, it's Shakespeare, it's elevated. And even like, when
elevated.
People talk about, right, it's elevated. Yeah. When people talk about Shakespeare, they're taught to think of him as the guy who used language in the most complicated, he had 25,000 words, you know, vocabulary, all this
he
kind of
he invented words that we still use today.
Exactly, right? But, I mean, when it comes down to it, like, Shakespeare had insight. Shakespeare stole a lot of shit. He was a plagiarist, you know. But he knew a good story when he saw one. And he made, like, dirty jokes. I mean, he's got sonnets about his junk, basically. You know, like, I remember when I first...
I teach sonnets to my students.
Yeah. When I first had a professor, it was like, this sonnet is about Shakespeare's penis. I was like, what? And he was like, let's look at it. And I was like, oh, my God, it is. He was like, he's just trying to figure out, you know, how he can make dirty jokes with the words, right? So that's elevated? No. It's like poetry is everyday stuff.
Right.
I don't remember if this is Nikki Finney or I can't remember who wrote this poem, but there's a poem called Poetry Should Ride the Bus.
Mm.
And that's the way I think about poetry. Mm. And it's all about, you know, the everyday things that we all experience, not this elevated stuff. I mean, it can go there, but our everyday experiences can be elevated through poetry.
Yes.
Okay. And I'm sorry if in the last few minutes I've said things that are offensive.
Junk. Goodness.
I think you're all over five.
We have to put a parental advisory now on our podcast.
I've been informed I've been saying things that are offensive. I just want to...
Yeah, and I think I appreciate this, like, juxtaposition between everyday and then the kind of elevation of these everyday ways of particularly of people mm-hmm. who are not mm-hmm. talked about in poetry mm-hmm. a lot, at least in the poetry that we read in classrooms, right? Like the shea butter
right.
moment, right? This like everyday moment of like a black mother or a black father like putting this on their child to protect mm-hmm. them. Like mm-hmm. I think I really like that sort of that. It's what do we elevate, right?
Although
or maybe
I think
not. Like, I don't
in some ways, what I'd prefer to do is not use the language of elevation just because it's dangerous in terms of feeding back into this kind of like dichotomy, right? Like what is high, what is low, what should count? I'd rather think of like what poetry explodes and makes possible in terms of ways of seeing, right? So that by expanding the vocabulary, the visual vocabulary of poetry, right? E-viewing is allowing us to see more and have a greater imagination, right? That include, right, in this poetic way.
So why poetry, why can only poetry do that, or can only poetry do that? Like, can other forms of literature also do this kind of exploding and opening up of imaginary spaces?
I think other literature can, but what I love about poetry, what it can do specifically, is really, it's so dense, right? And it makes you have to, right, like you should be confused to some extent.
Okay.
I, at least, you know, about like the possibilities of all the language in there. Like the one you were asking about the other day, the device.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
I love that.
Yes.
So the device.
Page 9.
Right, spends a lot of time. And it's written as a prose poem,
yeah.
Where we don't even know what this machine is. Yeah, we know a lot of people worked on it from all kind of backgrounds, disciplines. We know that they chose a child to turn it on, and we're like, what is this going to be?
Right.
And it's like so suspenseful. And so that then they turn it on, and it turns out that it will help African Americans in the present speak to their ancestors.
Yes.
And so on page 13, the young girl who's been chosen says, it is like yelling over a river. The poets had added that part, and it hadn't made much sense when she first practiced that line, but now it seemed right. I am your great-great-great-granddaughter. I'm the first person in history to use this device. People from all over are here with me watching. We have many questions for you. And other people will use the device to talk to their ancestors, too. So now, grandmother, my first question is, she looked down at the paper to get it exactly right. What words can you offer us to help us be free as black people in a world that does not love us? There's something about poetry, I think, in particular. Prose can do this too, right? Like, she clearly chose a prose form. But poetry asks you to really weigh those words and the choice of those words in this moment, both because we have the external story of the poets giving the girl the script, but also because as the form, as a poem, we're like, yes, right? Like, this has to be exactly right. How do you ask a question of ancestors? So that by the time it ends, right? Like, and spoiler alert, right? Like, I mean, I shouldn't have to do this, but I will. And all we get from the past is laughter. She laughed and laughed and laughed. The lights flicker and fade, and still the woman laughed. She laughed and laughed and laughed. That's all we're going to get. And we have to sit there with that laughter, just like in this moment the girl is in that whole auditorium. And sit with in that laughter and wonder, how do I go from here? Where do I go from here? And I don't know if prose demands that same kind of attention and commitment to being in there with the language and the choices in the same way. I don't know.
Can I pose this question?
Yeah.
Our last book that we read, Sing Unburied Sing, we were... I think we were talking about the same thing, maybe the difficulty we had of with the book in terms of it dealing with the very same issues that this book deals with. I'm not saying one book's better than the other, but
it's
saying how does this one, as poetry, allow us to be in those issues and sort of confront those issues in maybe a different way than a novel does, you know? So I started out, I was going to ask which one does it better, but I don't want to ask that.
Yeah, just different.
How they do it differently.
Yeah. Maybe it's something about the freeing up of, right, like there's sort of possibilities that free up when it's poetry, right? And I was thinking about your point about the, you know, the poems that start off typed and then like turn, like she writes them and it's kind of even imagined. So this is the one on 20, right? So the type part, basically she's, you know, talking about sort of walking somewhere and then somebody calls her the N-word and then And then, like, the written part, right, basically she sort of imagines this woman sort of being possessed by a mighty and exuberant ghost spirit. She stood up and began to dance despite herself, kicking and jumping and spinning here and there, hollering, turning cartwheels that made her bones creak and her dress turn upside down, throwing her hands to the sky and calling out to no one. I kept walking. And that was beautiful, because you're right. Like, I forget whether it was Todd or you who said that it's like, it's not like a violent reimagining, right? It's not that anything happens.
Yeah, so it wasn't revenge.
It wasn't revenge. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that would have been, maybe that's possible in the kind of poetry that she writes, right? Okay.
It's a difficult question. I mean, I wanted to say, you know, because I think that you suggested something about how poetry is in some ways tighter. But I would say, like, of course, poetry uses an economy of language, right? I mean, this is a very...
That's a better way to put it than I did.
Well, I didn't mean to suggest it was better, but I mean, you know, that's what I was thinking. But this book is it's a really thin book. I mean, it's, 70, 80 pages, something like that.
Right. 90.
90 pages, okay. So it's not nearly as long as your typical novel. But there's some way in which it accomplishes some of the same things. It still has that depth. It still has that complexity. It still has that emotional heft. And I wonder if one way I always think is that even within the economy, the brevity of a poem, that there's space inside of it. Maybe more space for your imagination, more space for you to kind of like inhabit. Like, you can read a poem and you can just get hung up on one image, right? Like, one particular image.
Yeah.
And that can mean everything to you in the poem. And I don't know, I can't come up with...
I have one, actually. This is page 23, and this is from the poem called Excerpts from an Interview with Meta World Peace, a.k.a. Ron Artest, a.k.a. the panda's friend. So the line that I loved was, an elbow is just a bent arm with some ambition. And if you can't handle that, why are you playing ball?
Yeah.
Yes. I love that. Well, and I don't even know how it actually relates to the rest of the poem. I'm just going to love that.
Do you know who Ron Artest is?
No, I don't. I did look up some of the people.
But I'm just saying, like, that's what I'm talking about. Like, you could be like, I need to do all this investigation, find out who Ron Artest is. If you find out who Ron Artest is, it adds a little bit to the poem, because he's a, like, maybe crazy, or maybe the deepest philosophical former NBA player that exists.
Okay.
Who has said a lot of really interesting, weird things.
Yeah.
And but that doesn't really matter.
Right.
It's that image, right?
Right.
It's and she's basically taking his words and turning them into a poem.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
There were names that I did look up, like Marilyn Mosby, who I feel like, oh, yeah, I know who she is, but then I looked up to make sure. But also, on a less happy note, right? This is on 87, the untitled anti-eulogy.
Oh yeah.
About Janila Watkins, who was a 6-month-old baby who was shot and killed, right?
And she'd actually, like, been shot when she was in her mother's womb, right? When the mother was still pregnant.
No, this was, she was in her dad. She was 6 months old.
Right, but she'd survived a shooting.
Oh, she'd been shot before.
So twice. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Wow. I didn't know that part.
Yeah, me neither. Wow.
This might be a really good moment, though, to kind of give an overall shape of the book, because I think, you know, to get to what you're talking about, Todd, like how there's so much here, what poetry offers to you as opposed to a novel is you can jump in, right, and you can read any of the poems and in any order, and you're still going to get a lot from it.
And these poems probably appeared other places by themselves, you know, before they were part of a collection, right?
But what I love about collections is that they take those poems, and they really do kind of arc them very deliberately. And so she has three sections. Mm-hmm. It starts out with true stories, which includes all these retellings, and seems to be principally organized around these half kind of realistic but also half fantasy imaginings of childhood life in Chicago, maybe. And then Oil and Water, which really moves to what I would call like embodiment and sexuality. So there's a lot about a female adolescence, like the Shea Butter Manifesto is here, the Erika Badu,
the
1001 Ways to Touch Your Own Face.
Yeah. And the one that you did a reading for me, which was Why You Cannot Touch My
Hair, which is brilliant. And then finally, the section that it ends with is Letters from the Flatlands, which really seems to be, in many ways, about, like, less about people and more about Chicago. So there's so many amazing poems in there. Let me just really quickly, because we haven't done this one yet, on page 51, she has a poem called Origin Story that is about her parents, presumably, right? And about how her parents met. But she talks about how her dad drew comic books and mimeographed communist newspapers, and her mother bought one of the comic books. And then she says, love is like a comic book. It's fragile, and the best we can do is protect it in whatever clumsy ways we can. And so she, you know, has this extended metaphor. And then the poem ends, and if my parents' love was a comic book, it never saw polyvinyl, never felt a backing. It was curled into a back pocket for a day at the park, lent to a friend, read under covers, reread hanging upside down over the back of the couch, memorized, mishandled, worn thin, staples rusted. A love like that doesn't last, but it has a good ending.
I love that poem.
So beautiful.
Yeah. You know, I wanted to say as you were reading that, this is another good thing that you should think about when you're reading poetry, is read it out loud to yourself.
Yes,
it,
definitely.
You can always hear it. It's meant to be read. You know, it's meant to be heard. So,
can I ask another question then about the structure?
Yeah.
So there's also, like, art.
Yes, good point.
So what's, I don't know, I'm curious about what people thought about that.
And I feel like it's pretty unusual, right? Like, there aren't, she apparently is an artist and a writer, she really wanted to have this kind of mixed media book.
I read something, an interview with her, where she talked about how this seems pretty normal to her, yet the fact that she's a sociologist, you know, she's a scholar, historian, or whatever she is, all those things, and then also a visual artist and a poet, and a performance artist, and she does all these things, right, that they should go together, you know, and why not put them together in a book, and, you know, I think If you go through this book trying to think, like, how does this all fit together? What, this piece doesn't seem to fit into this piece. I think if you're looking for this kind of, like, logical kind of fit together, it might not always work.
Okay.
Like, there's images in here that I don't really understand.
Right.
But they, I don't know, I feel something when I look. I mean, this one, the one Ekphrasis, it's on page 68.
Oh, is that what it's called?
Yeah. Jeez. Oh, the titles are.
Where is it?
The titles are in the table of contents. So, like, here.
Oh.
There's titles to them. The ones that are indented in
Todd,
italics.
You're brilliant.
I can read a table of contents.
Clearly, I can't.
But, you know, like, I don't know if I understand these, but there's some kind of, like, emotional response I have to them, and you know what I mean?
So ekphrasis is a word that means, but I bet anybody
doesn't know what it means.
But it's basically a poem that is kind of like styled after an art piece, right? So it's a poetic representation of art. And what's fascinating then is that this thing
she's presenting art
is
actually the visual art.
Yeah.
Oh,
but it has letters.
So that's really playful.
You know, it has typeset, you know, along the top of it.
And some of them
abattoir,
are words, right?
Yeah,
and the rooftop.
Yeah. And abattoir, which is one of those scary words.
What's that? What's
it's an SAT word.
It's a butcher, you know, like where they kill
really?
Cattle, I think.
Oh, man, I thought it was a bedroom.
Let's look that up. And maybe edit this out.
That's just,
no, let's keep it.
I'm wrong. I'm sure I'm wrong.
I do want to go back to the Erykah Badu poem while,
yes.
I guess,
we'll
I
look,
so while I look that up.
Well, can we go?
Before we get to
before
that,
before we get to that, I just want to make two comments about some of the images.
Yes.
We were talking
please.
About images.
It is a slaughterhouse, by the way.
Okay.
Good job.
Thank you.
Sometimes a bedroom.
All right.
Okay, we know too much about you now.
I'm just wrong all day long on this show.
So the two images that I really found very interesting were the one on page 4, the secret decoder ring, which if you look at it, when I first looked at it, I thought it was a police badge.
Yes.
Me too. Yeah.
But it says black girl at the top, and then at the bottom, secret decoder ring. And so I just thought, especially thinking it was a police badge, thinking about the power that black girls have, right? And then this connecting this to kind of some type of technology or ability to kind of understand and not, you know, to use the same word in the sense of to decode life. And mm-hmm. so I thought that was cool. And the caption says sensational, startling, new. What are they saying? Right? And black girls able to figure all of that out.
So is that like suggesting that black girls might have their own secret language?
Yeah. Okay. Yes. Out, yes. Right? So. Yes. 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 And then the second set of images, pages 82 and 83, and they are entitled, well, it's a picture of a chalkboard, mm-hmm. and it's entitled Tuesday, yes. given the Tuesday schedule. And actually, the schedule to me was also kind of a poem. Yeah. And so at 8:30, there's the Good Morning Circle. And this is from the perspective of the teacher. Mm-hmm. At 9 o'clock, I'm raising the children you have forgotten. At 10:15, and you have no goddamn clue. Then 11:05, there's lunch. And then 12:10, just pay me, pay me. At 12:55, I refuse to fold my hands. And so maybe that's a student. Mm. At 1:40, would you love them as your own, as I do? And then at 2:30, dismissal. And so thinking about kind of E-viewing's consistent commentary on school and education, I thought this image slash text was a very interesting way to visualize that. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, and on the top of that it says, it can be accomplished, only piecemeal consciousness intent upon the world.
Yeah.
So, I really love that image. I mean, so there's kind of the one part of the image, there's like stuff written on the board and kind of erased out.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of the,
which you were going to take us somewhere.
Yeah.
Hmm? Oh, just the Erykah Badu one, we wanted to talk about it. Because it also had one of my favorite phrases in there, too. Okay. And of course, I'd found it, and I'm like, where is Erykah Badu?
29.
Thank you. I love that. Well, first of all, Erykah Badu. Yay.
Yeah.
So there's kind of this part at the end of the first stanza, and she says, and so at school, I learned that my body was a worksheet, full of blank spaces and mysterious, menacing forms. And the best I could hope was that someone more knowledgeable than I was would know what to do with them. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was really lovely. Mm-hmm.
My favorite lines from the same poem on page 31. Sometimes being an artist means walking faster mm-hmm. than everybody, shedding mm-hmm. your clothes like the devil had dressed you in his own best ideas.
Yeah, I like that, the whole second section. So you get, like, mm-hmm. each section is divided by a number word in italics, right? So first, and then the second one is this. It says, a man can be many things, a snare drone or a willow tree with its branches dragging down into muddy water, the white rind of a watermelon or a run in your stockings, or the moment when you see your name written on the inside of a desk at school and it wasn't you who wrote it. But you can be your own gin and your own best sip too. You can make with him a nation and still be sovereign.
Yes.
Your own gold coin and your own honest trade. Mm-hmm. You can touch his hand and still be your own snapping fingers when the snare has gone quiet.
Yes.
One of my favorite sections too. Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
That again, you know, about, like, think of that. And we all have this, I'm sure. Lessons that you learned from some important artist in your life, right?
Mm-hmm.
How their art changed your life, made you understand something, see something in a different way. And in this case, to see herself, right?
Yeah.
A body which she didn't understand, which was taught to her in this alienating way.
Mm-hmm.
And then to hear someone else talk about, I mean, that whole album, you know, is so much about taking, you know, power over your own life.
Yeah.
And, you know, I used to love that song. Isn't that song, Tyrone's on that album, isn't it?
Yeah, Call Tyrone.
Tyrone.
Yep.
And I remember when that came out, everybody was like, oh, this song is so... And I was like, I used to think it was about being vengeful or something, you know, like, but it's not about that. It's about protecting yourself.
Right. Right.
It's about treating yourself right and not allowing anyone to treat you wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like when she says, which is referenced in the poem, you don't ever buy me nothing.
Oh, and I love that.
She don't mean like, she doesn't mean like,
things.
I gotta have things.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like, you don't treat me well. You don't, you don't appreciate who I am.
Right.
And if you did, you would buy me the things that I need or that make me feel good.
Right.
And that doesn't have to be diamond rings or anything like that. It's just the things that, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I love the way she puts that, right? I mean, if he don't buy you an ice cream cup, right. I mean, if he don't buy you time when you had none, I mean, if he don't buy your Fantastic Tales, calls them nonsense, mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. then he's gotta go.
Then he's gotta go.
Yes. Absolutely. And I also love the next part, right? And she says, "Let me be clear, there's nothing wrong with finding rapture in the broke or the broken. But what you should ask for is a place on the park bench where all the bits and pieces are everywhere. And you should hand you the bottom of a smashed up Coke bottle, like the best kaleidoscope. And you should hold it up to the light together and watch the colors turn and spin. And that is more than good enough until you can get the groceries together."
Yes.
And mark that off too.
So, that is beautiful.
I wish you, our audience, could see how everybody Anita reads something. She sort of just missed up just a little bit.
Just a little bit.
She's being very...
She's
moved
inside
by this.
The poetry.
Exactly. Yeah. It's exactly what we're talking about. Yeah. Exactly what we're talking about.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the formality of some of the poems, just because we've talked about the art, right? There's this... And we've talked about the sound. So there's really great experimentation throughout Eve Ewing's book. There's a way in which every time you think you've kind of figured out the form by which she's going to communicate, you have to kind of switch gears. And I especially love when she takes these really classic forms like the Sistina. Or
what is a Sistina?
I'll tell you in a second.
She's going to explain.
or the sonnet, and she like just kind of explodes your brain a little bit. So a sestina is basically, it's an Italian form, and it braids. So the endings, you'll notice in the very first stanza, are home, curiosities, victory, ice, black, and lonely.
She's reading from... You're reading from...
This is
page 16.
Page 16. And then, if you'll notice, home becomes the ending of the second line. Mm. So basically, it's braided. The sixth line becomes the ending of the first line. Mm. And
the same six words in every stanza, the lines of each stanza.
I didn't notice that.
So in like a really classic Sistina, and then in the last stanza, all six are compressed into the last three lines.
Oh.
You get this kind of way in which the meanings of the words change in really effective ways because you're being asked to hold onto the same word but trace it along the braid.
And that kind of repetition with a difference, right?
Like, yeah.
So this poem, which, you know, Sistina with Matthew Henson's fursuit, I had to look up Matthew Henson's fursuit.
And he is not the guy who voiced Elmo, which is what I thought.
I think that's a decent
guess. Fursuit? I thought it was like Elmo's suit.
Nope.
But Crystal knows who he is because of a Chicago thing.
Right, yeah. Tell us. Matthew Henson was an Arctic explorer, and I know him because of kind of growing up in Chicago and learning about Jean Point du Sable, who was also kind of an explorer and the person who discovered Chicago. And so I know Matthew Henson in the same vein as du Sable. And so, and then also thinking about the fursuit, thinking about what you would need to survive in a real cold place. Yeah.
So the Sistina, like, takes this image, right, Matthew Henson's fursuit, the first African-American explorer in the Arctic, and also, like, thus kind of unique and special, but also alone, right, in a wintry place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and can I add in that the thing about him is, like, he went with Robert Peary to the North Pole, and Robert Peary was, like, by the time they got to the North Pole, Robert Peary was, like, all crippled up in a sled, you know, with ice of frozen toes and everything like that. And Matthew Henson was really, like, leading the expedition at that point, but he didn't get credit for it, right?
Okay.
Like,
classic.
Many black people who were brought along and who played major roles, he didn't get credit for what he actually accomplished. He was actually of that expedition, which was the first Westerners to get to the geographic North Pole. He was the first one to step on the North Pole. Who gets credit for finding the North Pole?
Right.
That's good. Because what I was going to say is, like, it takes that feeling of kind of loneliness and desolateness and uses it to talk about this trip with other African American poets on a like a fellowship kind of thing in a small town where they are probably the only black people around. And just to trace one word then, right, like in the very first stanza, she's talking about being dressed in black in this small town far from home. And loneliness is there, right? Like, it's one of the words that's circling. In the next stanza, she talks about the children, like, painting their nails black, so we have a sense of the culture there. But it's still about a black externality, right? By the third stanza, they're confronted by this shop owner who demanded to know why we were black. So race and racism emerge really powerfully. Like, and they're not as present in those first two stanzas, right? It just, like, the third stanza brings it up. And then we get that stanza that you and I have talked about. The work of the poet is not unlike the work of being black. Some days it is no work at all, only ease, cascading victory, the plenitude of joys and questions and delights and curiosities. Other days you wonder if exile would be too lonely, and figure it can't be worse than thinking you won't make it home, the fear of your own teeth skidding across the ice. And I feel like that's in some ways like this climax of the poem, you know, but then you still have to, right, like you have this climax and you still have to move through the rest, right, as they trundle home, trying to find some degree of safety and comfort in each other in what is a really harsh world. So that the last stanza is, we held hands and watched the others turn to ice, their silhouettes hazy and black. Blackness is now out there. And they are home together.
So safety and that kind of solidarity of groupness, but also the fur suit too, right? Borrow that it's like armor. You know, of course, the fur suit is armor against the cold,
right, in
the way that he wore it. But this is armor against that cold and loneliness, and a way to bring people, those four people, together.
And did you want to talk about the sonnet?
Oh, right. Let's really quickly look at the sonnet.
53.
Thank you. So it's after Terence Hayes, and Terence Hayes is an African American experimental poet. So I think that's partly why, you know, like she has this homage to him. The sonnet basically is, you know, the usual 14 lines. They're all the same line. I saved some cornbread for you in the skillet on the stove.
I wish someone would say that to me more often.
Right?
No.
And that's apparently what she said. She's like, I think this is the perfect expression of love. So sonnets are traditionally love poems. And she takes that impetus of the form and she says, I saved some cornbread for you in the skillet on the stove. I saved some cornbread for you in the skillet on the stove. I saved some cornbread for you in the skillet on the stove. And that's the poem.
Okay.
And I feel like there's something just really... it's funny. It is really funny, but it's also really beautiful in the way it takes cornbread. Like, we were talking about something so simple and modest and makes it the work of love, or the... It is...
Expression.
Yeah.
Expression of love.
Okay.
You buy that?
I do.
Yeah. This is good.
I do. I am convinced.
Yeah.
All right. And we should start to wrap up. So please do.
I wonder if we can end by thinking about the last poem of the book, which is called Affirmation. And I was sitting here kind of reflecting on, again, our last book, Jessamine Ward's Sing Unburied Sing, and how I was feeling after that, and then comparing that to how I feel after reading Eve Ewing's poetry. And I think this poem really kind of speaks to how I feel, and it also speaks a little bit to, I will just say it is striking me not only just as a poem from this book, but as something that I should probably say for the rest of my life to myself, because it's just a wonderful way to end the book. So the poem is called Affirmation, and she dedicates it to youth living in prison after Assata Shakur. And so it just is asking us to... to think about the fact that after all we've been through, after all we've experienced, And even if we don't have a measure of physical freedom, we still are alive.
Do you want to choose a line in particular, a set of lines that... I mean, the whole thing is...
That, yeah, that's... Yeah. Well, maybe I can just start from the beginning. I believe that I woke up today and my lungs were working miraculously. My voice can sing and murmur and ask miraculously. My hands may shake, but they can hold me or another. My blood still carries the gifts of the air from my heart to my brain miraculously. Put a finger to my wrist or my temple and feel it. I am magic. Life and all its good and bad and ugly things, scary things, which I would like to forget, beautiful things, which I would like to remember, the whole messy, lovely, true story of myself pulses within me. I believe that the sun shines, if not here, then somewhere. Somewhere it rains and things will grow green and wonderful. Somewhere inside me, too, it rains, and things will grow green and wonderful. Sometimes my insides rain from the inside out, and then I know I am alive. I am alive. I am alive.
That's pretty nice, right?
Yeah.
Everyone's crying.
Yeah.
And I think that's the two lines that you started off saying, speak this to yourself until you know it is true.
You guys, at risk of like stepping on that beautiful reading, I just wanted to say, like, I was thinking about the device again as you were reading that. And when I first read the device, I thought, oh, that laughter is like sarcastic laughter, like, why are you asking me? But then I thought, maybe it's the laughter, like, they're alive.
Yeah.
They're alive in the future.
Yes.
Like a celebratory laughter, because it fits so perfectly with that message from that poem, right?
And I was actually thinking about the laughter and the device as thinking about us understanding our ancestors of having joy during...
See, that's not the way I read it the first time. I read it in a much more sort of like cynical
bleak
way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, as in like, the answer is nothing, right? There is nothing. Mm-hmm. But what if it is...
Yeah.
They're alive.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm so happy.
Yeah.
And that is a beautiful place to end. At least our discussion of the book. We will go around quickly and tell you what else we're reading. What am I reading right now?
I'm going to be super honest. I'm not reading anything. I am 1 week, as we're recording this podcast, I am 1 week away from spring break, and I'm just trying to stay afloat. So I'm reading what I'm supposed to be reading for class, but nothing outside of that.
Totally fair.
It is fair.
I just started reading A Wrinkle in Time, only to try and get it read a little bit at least before... Oh, I'm seeing the movie directed by Ava DuVernay, who's one of my celebrity crushes, and I'm so excited. Okay, I'm done.
Well, I'm kind of like Crystal. I'm not really... I read like 9 books at a time, because especially during the semester. Mm-hmm. So I'm teaching right now. The book that I'm teaching right now that I really love is Adrian Matika's The Big Smoke, which is a collection of poetry about the Jack Johnson, first Black heavyweight champion of the world. And that's been really fun to teach to read with students. I also just got a copy of the book. What's it called? You know, the old TV show with Sidney Poitier and...
In the Heat of the Night.
Oh! That's it. It's based on a novel that I didn't know. And so I just got the novel. It's by John Ball is the author. And I'm going to be reading that soon. And I also want to mention that I'm reading... So on my Kindle, when I get into bed, I'm reading Too Much Blue by Percival Everett, which is his newest book out. So
cool. I like his work.
Yeah, I love him. He's one of my favorite writers.
So I have The Sympathizer on my bedstand, and I'm making my very slow way through that. But the other thing that I devoured in 3 days, a colleague of mine, friend of mine from St. Olaf, came out with a novel, The Rending in the Nest. Her name is Kata Schwen. It is.
Was she on the radio recently, maybe?
I'm sure.
I think I just heard about it.
So it's a novel. It's a post-apocalyptic vision, right? What happens after, the rending, which, you know, basically a bunch of people and things are all disappeared. No one knows exactly what happens. I read it, no, seriously, 3 days. It's really intense. It's set in Minnesota, so you kind of can try to figure out, like, what the landmarks are. And it really is around... both the pain of giving up these old stories, right? You have memories of your life before the rending. What becomes of them? Like, how do you manage living in a world that can no longer be what you thought it would be? And then the possibilities. So what will be the new future? I totally recommend it.
Cool. So before we end, I just want to say thank you to my fellow podcasters for making me feel so much better about reading poetry. So we try to read more of it and try not to feel intimidated.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And also, just FYI, thank you all for listening. And in about a month, we'll be back at you. We're going to be reading Audre Lorde Zammi. So check us out on that. And yeah, we will see you in about a month. See y'all.
Bye.
As always, The Drip is recorded at Lake Coffee House on Lake Street in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Our theme music is by KG House with a snip from 1234. We'll be back in a month to talk about Audre Lorde's biomythography, Zammi. So be sure to check it out, and we'll see you back here in April. Listen up after the podcast for us reading some poetry from Eve Ewing. Peace!
And if the hippies and the yippies... And if the hippies and the yippies... And if the hippies and the yippies...
Thursday morning, Newberry Street. And today, when I walk out, there's a black boy. We mirror one another, dressed alike, except that he's wearing a snapback and I'm not. We look at each other, wide-eyed, before Dr. opens the door and invites him in. When it is shut, I am not supposed to be able to hear anything. That is what the jazz is for, but I hear very well. I hear the smooth sound of skin against skin, first the slip of the palms and then the gentle thud. I hear them greet one another in the way that they can, the way no one else can. I think that maybe if we guard ourselves and each other, if we can keep from losing our minds alone in quiet rooms, and can at least lose them side by side, we may live through the year.
So this is Chicago is a Chorus of Barking Dogs. Subtitle Logan Square Night, May 30, 2015. Girl, child, you fearless winter, you gathering of pigeons before a lasting fountain. We don't want you to be afraid of the dark like we were. We want you to be able to be alone sometimes, the way we never could and still can't really. But who can blame you, baby, in our city of glass?
What I mean when I say I'm sharpening my oyster knife. I mean I'm here to eat up all the ocean you thought was yours. I mean I brought my own quarter of a lemon, tart and full of seeds. I mean I'm a tart, I'm a bad seed. I'm a red-handled thing, and if you move your eyes from me, I'll cut the tender place where your fingers meet. I mean, I never met a dish of horseradish I didn't like. I mean, you're a twisted and ugly root, and I'm the pungent, stinging firmness inside. I mean, I look so good in this hat with a feather, and I'm a feather, and I'm the heaviest featherweight you know. I mean, you can't spell anything I talk about with that sorry alphabet you have left over from yesterday. I mean, when I see something dull and uneven, barnacled and ruined, I know how to get to its iridescent everything. I mean, I eat them alive. What I mean is, I'll eat you alive, slipping the blade in sideways, cutting nothing, because the space was always there.
What I talk about when I talk about Black Jesus, an excerpt. Ever since Black people came to this country, we have needed a Moses. There has always been so much water that needs parting. It seems like all Black children, from the time we are born, come into the world in the midst of a rushing current that threatens to swallow us whole if we don't heed the many, many warnings we are told to heed. We come into the world as alchemists of the water, bending it, willing it to bear us safe passage and cleanse us along the way, to teach us to move with joy and purpose, and to never, ever stop flowing forward into something grand waiting at the other end of the Delta. We're a people forever in Exodus.